From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. On day 33 of the partial government shutdown, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has resurfaced and scheduled votes on two bills tomorrow that could reopen the government. McConnell and other Republicans are backing one that includes the money the president has demanded for his border wall, something the president has made a condition of reopening government. Senate Democrats back a bill that funds the government through February 8th while negotiations continue. Democrats have made opening the government a condition for negotiating. NPR congressional correspondent Scott Detrow is here. Hi, Scott.
Hey there.
And first take up the return of Mitch McConnell, off the radar for 5 weeks. What's the talk there about his absence?
Well, you know, I think he and a lot of Senate Republicans felt pretty burned in December. They held a vote, a unanimously approved bill to fund the government without a border wall. Their understanding was that President Trump would sign it. He didn't sign it. He reversed course. The House changed the bill to include a border wall. And here we are more than a month later. So at the time, Mitch McConnell said, well, I'm just not going to hold a vote on anything until Democrats and President Trump agree on it. Of course, this is not that. This is a bill that the president would support, but Democrats still disagree with it. Still, the Senate is holding these two votes, and that's some sort of progress, except, of course, neither of them are likely to pass or end this shutdown.
Exactly. Given that's the thinking, are the sides doing anything to try to sweeten the pot?
Not at the moment on the Senate side, at least. We haven't seen any sort of movement or real conversations. We're seeing a little bit of movement on the House side today from House Democrats. It looks like we're expecting some sort of letter or some sort of counteroffer to come from Democratic leaders to the president at some point later today. The general idea of what we're hearing is, again, it's not too much different than what you were talking about before. Democrats are saying, reopen the government first, and then we are willing to spend billions, $5 billion more on border security. It's just that House Democrats don't want to spend it on a wall. They're in favor of spending it on things like increasing security at ports of entry, where they argue the drugs are coming through that the president is so focused on.
And the Democrats would say it's a disagreement over what kind of border security, while the president is saying, and his people are saying, that the Democrats don't want any security at all. Here's a former White House legislative director, Mark Short, who was on NPR's Morning Edition.
I think that the president is committed to getting border security, and he feels that he's frustrated with Congress's impasse, and this is the only way forward.
This being this demand for the wall. Look, this comes as former West Wing communication aide Cliff Sims, who's very close with President Trump, has a book coming out. It's titled Team of Vipers. He describes a White House out of control, according to The Washington Post, which got a copy of the book.
And he's a Trump ally.
And he is an ally of the president. Yeah. And right now, the White House is reportedly focusing on nothing else but this border wall. Where does that go?
Unclear. But I think I think there is a key factor in all of this, and that is Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill all feel repeatedly burned by the White House in negotiations. You know, Vice President Pence comes and floats something to Democrats, only to see President Trump undercut that the next day. Things like that happen over and over again, and both parties feel like it's hard to negotiate with President Trump right now because they're not sure what is said 1 minute, whether that applies 10 minutes later.
Now, look, Ben McAdams, who is the only Democratic lawmaker in the Utah delegation to the House of Representatives. He was saying, look, we have to continue to stay at the table. But he's in a red state. Are other Democrats feeling pressure from their constituents?
Well, I think two parts there. Mm-hmm. Certainly, a lot of Democrats are very mindful of how much so many of their constituents are suffering. People directly who haven't been paid for more than a month now and people who rely on these services. They're very aware that this is getting worse and worse every day. At the same time, they are aware that repeated polls, including several ones that came out this morning, show that the public is blaming President Trump, show that the idea of a border wall is still not popular with the public, and they feel like their stance of reopen the government first is the right stance to be on right now. So there's no pressure to change and suddenly vote for a wall.
NPR congressional correspondent Scott Detrow. Scott, thank you.
Sure thing. Talk soon.
Well, at the core of this government shutdown is immigration, but many cities and counties have taken matters of immigration into their own hands, several hundred of them deciding to limit local police from enforcing federal immigration policies. Miami-Dade County in Florida used to be one of those communities, but then reversed course And now the county is facing two federal lawsuits related to its cooperation with the federal government's Immigration Enforcement Agency. Danny Rivero from member station WLRN in Miami reports.
5 years ago, the Miami-Dade County Commission voted unanimously to no longer cooperate with the Obama administration's request to hold undocumented immigrants in local jails. And that's after they had already served time for a local crime or paid bond to get released. Commissioner Sally Hayman led that vote. And this is her celebratory press conference.
Miami-Dade County, up until recently, held in custody inmates having an immigration detainer placed on them by ICE. ICE is Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And sometimes that would be the sole reason for keeping men and women locked up.
At that time, the county was in a budget crisis, and Commissioner Hayman zeroed in on this issue. When the county held undocumented immigrants for the feds in local jails, it was not getting reimbursed. And this was costing local taxpayers millions of dollars.
Not only is it about saving money, it's about saving people. And the cost and the consequence to our community of immigrants and who they impact was substantial.
Advocates, including Jonathan Freed of the immigrant rights group We Count, were thrilled that the county would stop cooperating with ICE.
What it means is that hundreds and thousands of families won't be separated.
But in 2017, Commissioner Hayman voted to reverse her own policy. The driver behind this shift, Donald Trump, ran for president.
Block funding for sanctuary cities. We blocked the funding. No more funding.
In the lead up to his victory in 2016, Trump promised to end so-called sanctuary cities. That year, the Obama administration had put Miami-Dade County on a list of sanctuary cities. They cited the county's policy to not comply with requests to hold immigrants in local jails unless it was reimbursed for the cost. And the Obama administration actually did float the idea of cutting some federal funding to places like Miami-Dade. At that point, Commissioner Sally Hayman, who's a Democrat, by the way, started getting active in Washington trying to get the county off the sanctuary city list. She argued that Miami-Dade never officially considered itself a sanctuary city.
I honestly felt we should not accept a label without a definition.
And then, when Donald Trump won the election, she said she panicked.
I got with the mayor and expressed great concern that our policy not only remained legal, but didn't aggravate the new administration, because I felt there would be great retribution.
5 days after taking office, President Trump signed an executive order directing the federal government to cut funds from sanctuary cities. The very next day, Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez issued his own order. The county would again start holding undocumented immigrants for the federal government. He was the first major mayor of a big metropolitan area to do this. And Trump tweeted, "Right decision. Strong." Protests broke out in Miami, and Mayor Jimenez went on national media. He said the county just couldn't afford to be considered a sanctuary city anymore. Here he is on Fox News.
We're being threatened with millions of dollars in federal funding that we need to provide services for the 2.7 million people of Miami-Dade County.
The county commission also took up a vote.
Ratify not the mayor's order, but what we had in 2013.
Carlos Martinez is Miami-Dade County's public defender. He spoke at that meeting and argued local jails shouldn't hold immigrants for the federal government. A few years earlier, he had made the same arguments, including that it cost Miami-Dade taxpayers millions of dollars. But this time, the arguments didn't work.
It was surreal to be showing up back before the same commission, had the same commissioners that we had had before, and all of a sudden the arguments that were made before as to why pass the ordinance, the resolution to begin with, all of a sudden that was insufficient.
When the commission passed the new resolution, they specified the federal government doesn't have to reimburse the county. This time, the commission was okay spending the county's own money to risk not losing other federal funding.
What it said to me was that their stated support for the immigrant community was very shallow.
Again, Jonathan Freed of the immigrant rights group We Count.
That they could throw folks under the bus so easily when President Trump made that threat.
We Count is now suing Miami-Dade for changing its policy, saying holding immigrants for the federal government is unconstitutional. A second lawsuit against Miami-Dade, using the same argument, is also moving forward. Commissioner Sally Hayman believes she did the right thing in reversing her own policy to protect funding for Miami-Dade County. She asks, what if we'd missed out on money the county needed for Hurricane Irma recovery, for example? But at the same time, she's glad there's legal challenges to President Trump's order.
Yay for the courts.
Meanwhile, six states and cities like New York, Chicago, and San Francisco are also suing the federal government on the grounds that forcing them to hold immigrants is unconstitutional. The lawsuits say these were requests, not legal obligations to cooperate with ICE. To date, the Trump administration has not withheld federal funding from any sanctuary city. For Here and Now, I'm Danny Rivero in Miami.
Just as Los Angeles teachers reached an agreement to end a strike, teachers in Denver voted to start a strike as soon as next Monday. The union has been negotiating with the district for more than a year to overhaul the compensation system because of high turnover. Schools are open today in Denver as the superintendent of schools meets with the new governor of Colorado, Jared Polis. The governor joined me for an interview yesterday before the strike was approved to talk about a range of issues. Polis is a 43-year-old Democrat who just took over as governor from Democrat John Hickenlooper earlier this month. Polis had represented Colorado's second district in Congress since 2009. Before that, he made hundreds of millions of dollars in the dot-com boom after starting a number of internet companies. When he was elected governor, Jared Polis became the first openly gay elected governor in America. Jared Polis, welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, Jeremy.
And I want to start by asking you just how the government shutdown is affecting you in Colorado. And since you're a Democrat, do you think that Democrats should compromise over border wall funding to end it?
Well, you know, it takes two sides to make this ongoing shutdown continue to occur. I just wish that they would reopen government. The effects are already being felt. We are terribly concerned by a number of things. We already implemented an emergency rule to allow our federal employees in our state to access unemployment insurance. Because a lot of people haven't been paid in a month, and you know, most people have rents and mortgages. We've already had over 2,500 Coloradans who are federal employees who haven't been getting paid apply for unemployment. We're terribly concerned about SNAP and other transfer payments that will hit our most vulnerable populations starting March 1st. So there's a lot of concerns, and I hope Republicans and Democrats in Washington reopen government while they debate whatever other disagreements they have. They might disagree about border security, but they should debate that with the government open, not with the government closed.
Is it stopping you from enacting your agenda? You just started as the governor of Colorado in the middle of this shutdown.
Well, you know, I think the real cost of the state will start around the end of February, early March. The accessing the unemployment trust fund, we have the money in there, but we do rely on government being reopened for it to be paid back by those same workers that are now able to draw down their paycheck. So, I mean, we're obviously making a bet here that the federal government will reopen and won't be closed forever. And as long as that's the case, then we'll be made whole with our trust fund.
You're succeeding a Democratic governor there in Colorado. How do you think that your tenure is going to be different from his, or what was he not able to accomplish that you want to?
Well, we're really very focused on consistent support for our big goals, and those include saving people money on healthcare. We want to implement free full-day kindergarten in Colorado, which will save families money. We want to reduce the tax rate for individuals and small businesses by going after corporate loopholes and tax expenditures on a revenue-neutral basis. And we want to make sure the state is positioned to achieve 100% renewable energy by 2040. So those really big four things underscore what our agenda is, and we'll look forward to working on everything else, big and small, to improve the quality of life for Coloradans.
There are activists also calling on you to halt all new drilling in Colorado. Or what do you think about that idea?
Well, I'm sure there's lots of people calling on us for lots of things. We are focused on the clean energy transition, as I indicated. We all know that we're not there today. Our goal is to get there as soon as we can. And that is not only because we care about climate, it's also because of air quality. And the fact that the pollution increases our asthma rate, our cancer rate, and healthcare costs. And it's also about making sure that Colorado can benefit from the green energy economy and that we have good green jobs that can never be outsourced right here in Colorado.
So is that a no on halting all new drilling in Colorado?
Well, again, there's a lot of people I'm sure that would like us to see us have less drilling, more drilling. I mean, there's many people with many different demands in that area. Our goal is transition to 100% renewable energy as soon as we can, and we all know we're not there today. But we want to accelerate the retirement of coal and natural gas power so we can benefit from cheaper, more reliable, cleaner wind and solar energy.
How would you describe yourself politically?
Well, I'm just, you know, trying to do my best to improve the quality of life for the people of Colorado. So, I mean, we're just focused on more money in people's pockets, saving people money, supporting, you know, freedom and allowing people to make choices and live their lives and thrive in Colorado. So it's not, I never really saw politics as about left versus right. I see it about forward versus backward. And I'm certainly a future-facing, forward-looking governor. And I think the fundamental challenge of my governorship will be how do we make the future work for Colorado and for Coloradans with all the great technological and social changes that our state and our country and the world are undergoing.
But would you call yourself a conservative Democrat, do you think?
Well, I would again say forward looking. Mm-hmm. It's not about I've never viewed anything on that continuum. There's people mostly on the right who call me super liberal. There's people on the left who call me conservative. There's people in the middle who call me everything from Sunday. I think what he says, you can call me anything you want as long as you don't call me late for dinner.
Right. Now, you are taking over as the first openly gay elected governor. We note that just this week, the Supreme Court upheld President Trump's ban on transgender people serving in the military as it makes its way through the courts. How would you describe the state of LGBT rights in this country right now? What do you think?
Well, it's unfortunate that President Trump, against the recommendations of our senior military leaders, is excluding perfectly capable soldiers with strong performance ratings simply because of their gender identity. It makes us weaker as a country and prevents the very cohesion of our military units that lead to a strong defense. So that's unfortunate. Certainly across the country, you know, just the other day, I marched in the Martin Luther King parade in Denver. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting to see sign of the pendulum, you know, swing back and forth. At a time of great progress, when Colorado elected its first African-American congressman, when we celebrate the right of loving same-sex couples to marry, there's also great pushback on the other side. And we see some of that as well with some of these divisive statements that the president and others have made.
What does your personal first mean to you? How important is it that you're the first openly gay elected governor of any state?
Well, it's never about that. It's really about how can I be an effective governor that improves the quality of life for Coloradans? Whatever aspect of diversity you bring to the job is not the yardstick that the voters, straight or gay, will measure your performance by.
I want to ask you about a couple of issues that Colorado has some experience with and the rest of the country may want to learn something from, starting with marijuana. Colorado was one of the first states to have legal recreational marijuana. Now a lot of other states have followed. What advice would you have at this point for other states as they start to go down this road? Are there problems that you're seeing in Colorado right now that you're having to deal with because of legalized recreational marijuana that you would warn other states about?
Well, you know, as one of the first states to implement it, we, get a lot of extra business from people coming into our state. I was down in Trinidad, Colorado recently. We have a lot of New Mexico tourists coming about. It's really helped to revitalize the downtown area, arts and cannabis. So from the economic perspective in Colorado, I'd love other states to go slowly so that we can continue to see all these benefits for Colorado.
Any warnings for them?
I, for years I'd been sort of countering this sort of dire picture of Colorado. But again, if they think that it's bad, it's better for us to have less competition at this point. So, I mean, if I'm looking at it as governor, I would hope they halt their efforts and send all their business here.
What about the issue of guns? Obviously, Colorado has had its share, more than its share, of mass shootings. What do you think needs to be done at the federal level about guns?
Yeah, I mean, if you're directing it towards Washington, we need to be willing to have the discussion. I think it's been, in many ways, just sort of third rail issue that just hasn't been debated. They should be willing to talk about things that Colorado has in place, like universal background checks. You know, we should have that nationally, no matter where you are, to prevent criminals from illegally purchasing weapons. In Colorado, there's a lot of discussion around, which we already have, you know, universal background checks, but around creating a way that there can be a temporary court order for somebody who's a danger to themselves or others, having a mental health crisis, to temporarily lose access to their weapons until they can recover and once again administer those safely.
Did that issue come up during your campaign? Do you have to appeal to people on both sides when it comes to the Second Amendment?
Well, sure. You know, we're certainly a state of gun owners, a state of sportsmen and hunters, of people who own guns for home defense. There's nothing at all inconsistent with our Second Amendment rights and sensible, reasonable gun safety laws like universal background checks and like a way to prevent people that are having a mental health crisis from purchasing an arsenal of weapons.
That is Jared Polis, the new governor of Colorado. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Key West has taken a step against chemical sunscreens. Last week, the Key West City Commission voted to ban the sale of sunscreens that contain the chemicals oxybenzone or oxinoxate. Researchers have found that those chemicals get into the water and damage coral reefs. But some dermatologists are concerned that banning the chemicals could limit sunscreen options. Dora DiMaria of the environmental group Reef Relief told WLRN in Miami that there are other options for sunscreens.
It's not like we're taking sunscreen completely away. We are just replacing the sunscreen with the bad ingredients with sunscreens that have good ingredients.
The commission will hold a second vote on the proposal in February before it can become law. And Key West would follow Hawaii, which recently banned those two chemicals in sunscreens. That law takes effect in 2021.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The Federal Aviation Administration said today it briefly halted 43 flights inbound for Newark Liberty International Airport in New Jersey last night after one drone, maybe two, were seen flying nearby at 3,500 feet, high above their legal altitude. The incident lasted for 21 minutes, and it recalls the one at Gatwick Airport in London, which grounded flights over the course of 3 days in December. Joining us is Robert Wall, senior editor for Aerospace and Aviation at The Wall Street Journal in London. Robert, are drones delaying flights or canceling flights or making them stay away from the airport the new normal?
I think that's a distinct possibility, at least for the foreseeable future. There's some real concern, I think, that that there'll be copycat events like this. As people find out, it may not be that difficult to disrupt flight operations.
Is there anything that the airports can do to stop the drones at this point with the technology that we have? Can they, you know, jam them or shoot them down or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, there is technology that's now coming out into the field that is available. It's certainly still a emerging industry, kind of like the drones themselves. So, you know, a few years ago, we weren't worried about drones, so you didn't have to worry about developing things to take them down. But there are certainly technologies. As you said, you could jam radar links. You could do things more forcefully, like shoot them down. Now, airports are particularly difficult, though. That's an environment where some of the stuff you don't want to do. For example, if you want to jam a communications link between the controller of the drone and the drone, you may, depending on the system, be, you know, canceling out all sorts of communications
right.
that you may need to talk to the airplanes in the sky. So it's, you know, it's not a trivial undertaking. And firing random shots in the air, especially when there's planes up there as well, and that's probably not the ideal solution.
So what's the answer to this then? If you can't do any of those things, would you just have to ban drones altogether?
Well, I think banning drones has limited effect. I mean, you know, the what person you're worried about is really the malicious actor. You can use jammers, but you want to use smart jammers, jammers that don't blanket the entire radar, radio frequency spectrum, but jammers that listen to find out what frequencies are being used by the controller talking to the drone and just jam that. For example, that's, you know, but those are things are tricky and can be not very cheap. You know, these are things the military might be willing to afford. But for an airport, you know, that kind of outlay starts to become real money.
Now, if a drone were to actually hit a plane, you think of a drone as a pretty small thing compared to an airplane, but it could cause some pretty serious damage and put people on that flight at risk.
Yes, and I will say part of the issue is with airports, I think, right now, and we actually don't exactly know what would happen. As you know, as most people know, aircraft engines ingest birds.
Right.
This happens occasionally. They're designed to take birds of a certain size, and usually things are fine. You know, Miracle of the Hudson is something else. Both engines got hit, but, you know, we don't really know what happens when it's a drone. I mean, clearly, it's a risk factor, and people aren't in the business of putting airplanes in harm's way if they can avoid it.
That is Robert Wall, a senior aerospace and aviation editor at the Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And let's get reaction now to reports that Sony's RCA Records has ended its contract with R&B singer R. Kelly after decades of allegations of sexual abuse of women and minors. All of the allegations summed up in a devastating Lifetime documentary series, Surviving R. Kelly, in which the singer's alleged victims say he held some of them hostage. Others, like Lisa Van Allen, said she was too afraid to leave, believing he'd track her down. She described life in his home.
One of his friends came to the studio, and he's speaking to everyone, and just a normal reaction, you speak back. Rob would get upset and say, you're not supposed to speak to them. You don't speak to anybody. You just look straight forward. If they speak to you, you don't say anything.
Well, R. Kelly has denied all the allegations, but the series has prompted the state of Georgia to open an investigation. Artists like Celine Dion and Chance the Rapper to pull their work with him. Chance tweeted, the truth is any of us who ever ignored the R. Kelly stories or ever believed he was being set up, attacked by the system, as black men often are, were doing so at the detriment of black women and girls. I apologize to all of his survivors for working with him and for taking this long to speak out. Well, campaigns like Mute R. Kelly have grown. Now his record label has reportedly dropped him. Oronike Odeleye is one of the founders of Mute R. Kelly. She joins us. And Oronike, your reaction to the RCA news?
Well, we were extremely pleased. We've been calling on them to do this for the past 2 years. And, you know, it took the documentary and kind of worldwide protest for them finally to listen and hope that this leads to them putting morality clauses into their contracts with these artists so we're not creating more R. Kellys in the future.
Devil's advocate for a second. What about letting the market punish R. Kelly in the way that it started to? I mean, Lady Gaga issued an apology to her fans on social media, pulled her 2010 collaboration with R. Kelly last spring. Spotify said that it would no longer promote his work based on its hate restrictions. What about letting the marketplace do this? Let people not buy his records?
Well, the problem with that line of thinking is that the market only works when people are fully informed and have full disclosure of all of the information. The mass public did not have full disclosure of this man's actions until this documentary came forward. But because he was such a moneymaker for the record company, they were insulating him from the masses.
What happens with the rest of the music industry? As you probably know, when Spotify announced it wouldn't promote his work, it's still carrying it. And there's a device on Spotify where you can mute an artist that you don't like, but it's still there. But just not promoting him prompted R. Kelly's lawyer, Joe Cascarelli, to tweet out a list of other musicians with egregious charges against them. Gene Simmons of Kiss, sexual battery. The Red Hot Chili Peppers, sexual assault among band members. Ozzy Osbourne, domestic abuse. I mean, the list goes on and on. Should all of that music disappear from our radar?
Well, Mute R. Kelly in particular was about amplifying the voices of the victims and trying to help them in their fight to get justice. So it's victim-led. And I would say that the victims of those artists have to decide how they want justice to be done. And if that is, you know, they want to take them to civil court or they want to take them to legal court and that be it, then that's fine because they are the ones who should get justice. If it is to go to the record companies and say, you guys are making a profit off of the sexual abuse of women. This is somebody who is doing criminal acts. There is no other organization out here where someone can be doing criminal acts and that organization will support them.
And I want to ask you about that part of this equation. I'm only going to play a few seconds of an R. Kelly song because this is obviously, you know, the antithesis of what you want. But just a few seconds of I Believe I Can Fly.
I believe I can fly.
It's a beautiful piece of music. And it's hard to ask people to turn their back on that piece of music, even though for decades we've been hearing that the artist behind it, well, decades ago we heard about a sex tape involving R. Kelly and a 14-year-old girl. Last week, Tracy Sampson said she dated R. Kelly for 2 years when she was 16. You know, these, as you said, are minors. I'm wondering if it's not just how beautiful some of the music is, that people wanted to embrace it, but also that particularly in the Black community, there is a history of Black men being unfairly vilified. And R. Kelly is comparing this to that. He's saying this is just like an old-fashioned lynching of Black men because they pose some sort of threat when it comes to sex. You talk about people protecting him. Is that a part of how this got to this?
His talent absolutely is a big factor. I mean, that's a wonderful song. And so we are emotionally tied to these things. When we hear them, we're thinking about our graduation and our barbecues and our house parties. We're not thinking about him holding 14-year-old girls in the studio with mattresses on the floor and buckets to use the restroom in. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not the association we make. And when we're talking about the difference between supporting a young woman or supporting a song, that choice should be easy.
And what about his claim that this is a public lynching?
This is not at all a public lynching. This is a public reckoning, and those are different things.
Aroni K. Odelea, co-founder of Mute R. Kelly, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, let's bring in someone covering the reports that R. Kelly's been dropped by his record label, Sony's RCA. Jem Aswad is senior music editor at Variety. And Jem, headlines say he was dropped. We're also reading they parted ways or that RCA froze his funding for new music. What's going on?
It's possible that all of the above is happening. RCA has not commented publicly on this at all, although R. Kelly's picture has been removed from its website. But sources tell us that it was a peaceful, if not necessarily amicable, parting of the ways. As I understand it, R. Kelly had two records left on his contract with RCA, in which case he was dropped, but they would have had to negotiate that exit. RCA is keeping his catalog. They just will not release any of his new music going forward, which they haven't done for 2 years anyway.
Well, so be clear here, because there's speculation that he was in the middle of a project that can't get finished, that he can't get the money to do his videos, although I'm thinking he has probably enough money of his own. But does this mean that there's a current project of his that was in production that's now stopped?
That is very possible, and I would assume, although again, there's no comment on this, that they're just going to give it to him. The last record he released came out in 2016, and he's released a few songs here and there since then, including a 19-minute-long song last summer called I Admit It, where he admits nothing.
A couple of things we want to get to. First of all, do you think R. Kelly will sue RCA?
A source told us that is not going to happen, but I can't imagine that Sony would have extracted themselves from that deal without that guarantee.
And is it possible to ever scrub an artist entirely? In other words, that's what some of the activists want. They don't want his music anywhere. Is that possible?
You know, what the activists are calling for, without making any value judgments here, that essentially amounts to censorship.
Yeah. And now we have a new issue with RCA. Just yesterday, singer Chris Brown was arrested in Paris on allegations of rape. Do you think that the record labels are waking up, that these are liabilities?
No, I don't think they're waking up at all, because RCA signed Chris Brown to a new deal 2 weeks ago, and they announced it right in the middle of the airing of Surviving R. Kelly. Mm. So, you know, I mean, it's hard to imagine what was going on there, but there are plenty of artists with felony convictions who have major label deals. And you can also say, to take the other side of that, that it is not the label's responsibility to police or monitor or sanction the behavior of their artists. But at a certain point, as RCA found out with R. Kelly, public opinion just catches up with you and the relationship becomes untenable.
Do you think R. Kelly will get another record label deal?
It's very possible he could work some sort of distribution agreement or a licensing agreement with a smaller independent label. Not that he even really needs one, because over the last couple of years, all he's done is just post a song on SoundCloud like any independent artist would.
Jim Aswad, senior music editor at Variety, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And this note, singer Chris Brown, again arrested in Paris after an allegation of rape, has been released. No charges, but an investigation has been launched, and he vehemently denies any wrongdoing.
The partial government shutdown is now in its 33rd day, and one place that is particularly worried about it is home of the Super Bowl. A week from this Sunday, that would be Atlanta. Joining us now is Keisha Lance Bottoms, the mayor of Atlanta. Mayor, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And you have called this uncharted territory. How has the shutdown impacted you in Atlanta already, given especially the fact that it's home to the world's busiest airport, which relies, just as all airports do, on TSA?
Well, that's where we're seeing our immediate impact on our airport. We fortunately have TSA workers who are continuing to show up at work, and TSA has sent additional support to us in anticipation of the Super Bowl. But what we know is that we're hurting in ways that are being experienced across the country. As our TSA workers are feeling the shutdown, we have more and more people calling in sick. But we are most concerned in Atlanta as we prepare for the Super Bowl for what we call Mass Exodus Monday. And that's when we expect a record number of passengers, upwards of 120,000 people, to go through our airport. And this could be very problematic if the shutdown is not over by then.
Do you have the ability to pay those TSA workers yourself to get them to work on that Mass Exodus Monday, or is that not something you can do?
Well, actually, we are very close to finalizing a plan to provide some financial support for our TSA workers. We're working along with our credit union, who supports the City of Atlanta for our City of Atlanta employees, and also many of our corporate partners, to create some type of fund that will allow us to extend the opportunity for loans to our TSA workers. You know, we're in uncharted territory, as I've said before, so we're having to come up with a plan in real time as people are experiencing the shutdown. We often prepare for natural disasters, but when you have something that a federal shutdown that really is a man-made disaster, this is something we've not had to plan for. And but I'm glad that we're having the support of partners across our city to allow us to respond very quickly.
Aside from the airport, are there any other ways in which the government shutdown is affecting you in a big way in Atlanta, especially in anticipation of the Super Bowl?
Well, I had a very disturbing message from one of our community partners who runs a Feed the Hungry organization. And what she shared is that she is increasingly concerned on the ground because she's seen very high numbers of federal employees who are coming in for support. And she likened it to what she saw after Katrina, when we had a number of people from New Orleans coming into the city for support. So that's of grave concern. So while we're focused on the airport right now, what we know is that in the community, our community is feeling it and our community partners are feeling it. So there's so much more work to be done beyond what we're doing for the Super Bowl.
What is your message to Washington about how to get out of this mess and how to end this shutdown?
leaders have to lead, and we can't be stopped by one position from the president that's not allowing us to have a reasonable conversation on what this compromise looks like.
So do you blame the president then for the shutdown?
Well, the president has called it a Trump shutdown, so I don't blame the president. The president claims it for himself. But what I do believe is that with our Senate and our Congress, I do think that there's a reasonable solution that can be had, and I hope that they will really engage in a reasonable conversation on how we get there.
What would your advice be for people who are coming to Atlanta for the Super Bowl and are worried about exactly what you've been talking about?
We're a bit less concerned about passengers coming in. Obviously, there are concerns about when they leave their respective cities, what their TSA experience will look like. But in terms of leaving out on Monday, we are encouraging people to get to the airport early. And we are opening up TSA lines at 3 a.m. on the Monday morning following the Super Bowl. So people can have a full Super Bowl experience. They can even go out after the Super Bowl and make their way directly to the airport so that they can begin to get out of the city.
Who are you rooting for in the Super Bowl, Mayor?
Well, I have offended enough fans with some comments I made leading up to last week's game. So I'm rooting for everybody who's coming to Atlanta to have a safe time in our city. And I can just say that it would be great to well, I'm going to stop it right there because I don't want to offend any other
football fans. What did you say that was so bad?
Well, leading up to the games, someone asked me, who did I want to see in the Super Bowl? And I said, anybody other than the Saints. And the Saints fans weren't happy about that. But, you know, we have a football rivalry. I love the people of New Orleans, but I'm a Falcons fan. So the thought of the Saints coming in, taking over our locker room was more than anybody could bear.
Okay. Well, that is the mayor of Atlanta, Keisha Lance Bottoms. Mayor, thanks for joining us.
All right. Thank you for having me.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.